Welcome back. I'm Charles Ellison, sitting in for Mark Steiner here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Mark Steiner is out today, and I am tasked with filling big shoes. So definitely honored to be here in the studio. Definitely appreciate the staff as well. Andre Melton on the board is still Mark Gunnery, producer. Also see some other folks in there who I'm just the shadows. I can't recognize right now at this moment, but definitely appreciate it. And we've got a great conversation lined up for you. I'm at Ellison Report. If you'd like to catch me via Twitter, as you know, I'm on the Ellison Report Sundays at 9 p.m. here on WEAA 88.9 FM. You can also go to at Steiner Show, I believe it is. Is that right? On Twitter? At Steiner Show on Twitter. If you'd like to tweet out to us, catch us if you can. Got a great conversation lined up. Obviously, we had a rather consequential night last night, a spate of primaries and critical states. And we're actually going to be discussing that with a super lineup of guests. We have actually one person who's actually on the Steiner Show quite frequently, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt. She's Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Also joining us by phone is Dr. Thomas Shaler. He's Professor of Political Science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Also writes a political column for the Baltimore Sun. He's also the author of The Stronghold, How Republicans Captured Congress But Surrendered the White House. I'm sure Dr. Shaler has quite a few thoughts as to what happened last night. Also joining us by phone is Eugene Craig, the third grassroots activist and third vice chair of the Maryland State Republican Party. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Excellent. Excellent. Also to you, the listeners, call in with your comments at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, at Mark Steiner. Excuse me, I said at Steiner Show. It's steinershow.org for the website. Comment on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page or send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. So we had a fairly stupendous night, another Super Tuesday, really. We had key states such as Florida, Illinois, Missouri, North Carolina, Ohio, for both determining who the next nominee for either party, Democratic or Republican Party, would be. And actually, quite a few delegates at stake. You had large states like Florida and Ohio, which were in play. Those are battleground states. I'd like to start with you, Kimberly. You know, kind of get your initial thoughts, your initial impressions of what happened last night. Obviously, some disappointments as well on the Republican side. So now it's now down to a two-man race, really. But I mean, you know, John Kasich, governor of Ohio, John Kasich wants you to think it's a three-man race, but it's still kind of a two-man race now. But some breaking news: Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump stepping out of the next Fox News debate that's coming up. So he's basically saying, "Hey, listen, let's wrap this up." Right. I want to get your initial thoughts on what happened last night.
Not only is he saying wrap this up, but he's also asking the party to wrap this up and let's get behind me so that we can actually beat Hillary, so to speak. That's the rhetoric that he's giving us. I think in terms of last night, what struck me the most, interestingly enough, was Rubio's speech to suspend his campaign. You know, it was a hard and tough loss for him to actually lose his hometown or home state, and to see that clearly the voters did not connect with him in a way that they wanted to see kind of the native son win their state, and instead went with Trump. And with it being a, you know, winner takes all state, it was very clear to him that this is not where he needed to continue to expend his resources. But I was very struck by many of the comments he made during the speech, which sounded as though he wanted to create this conciliatory move. Like, we've got to do more to bring the party together, but also bring the nation together. And so recognizing that some of, I don't know if he was owning up to, but at least recognizing that some of what had transpired or is transpiring in this campaign thus far has really created a number of divisions and created a divided nation that clearly is unsettled, restless, and unhappy with the current situation.
Tom, I wanted to get your thoughts as well, especially on the Republican side of things, and definitely we'll start checking in with what happened on the Democratic side. But Tom, I want to ask you, looking at Rubio's speech, looking at the tone of it, some of the language used, was that all about conciliation and avoiding a broker convention, unifying the party? Were there also signs of perhaps Rubio encouraging or over time, over the next several weeks, encouraging some of his supporters to coalesce around Donald Trump?
I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm a cynic on Rubio, even though, you know, I thought he was the most talented candidate in the race and really thought he was the favorite and certainly the darling of the quote-unquote establishment. I think a lot of it is rehabilitation for Rubio himself at this point. If he wants to have any kind of political future, and he's one of a couple of candidates younger than I am, he's 44, you know, he's no longer going to be a senator because he couldn't run for re-election and run for president. You know, obviously he could always lobby and do things, but if he wants to have an electoral career, and given some of the stuff that he did in the last couple of weeks, which he's, you know, seems embarrassed about and apologized for, I think that's really the only path back for him. I think he's going to bite his tongue. I don't think he's going to spend a lot of time raising money and stumping hard or give a glorious, you know, rah-rah speech for Trump in Cleveland. And so I think he'll mostly disappear from the scene and kind of wanted to go out on a high note.
Hey, Eugene. Go ahead, Tom.
I might be a little cynical on that, but that was my sense of it.
Hey, Eugene, well, why the, as Tom says, the tongue biting? Why now suddenly? Because you had a lot of Republicans over the past few weeks, folks like Marco Rubio with his hand jokes, and, you know, others like Mitt Romney. You know, you also had Republican congressional leadership jumping in, disparaging Trump, saying that they didn't like this particular person representing their party. But I am noticing just gradually folks kind of accepting that they need to coalesce around it. Why the tongue biting after, you know, a lot the Trump rhetoric, the divisiveness on the campaign trail, now violence sparking out in the campaign trail? We had that happen over the weekend in places like Chicago, Cincinnati, St. Louis. So that's what's going to happen now. Republicans are pretty much just going to accept Donald Trump as the nominee and just kind of go along to get along.
Well, I think there are a couple different perspectives here. Starting with, you know, we will not have a nominee on the first ballot. I see this thing going to multiple ballots in Cleveland, and I see it being very, very interesting to say the least. I think there are a couple of different forces at play here. There are a couple of different schools of thought. There's one school of thought that, you know, we figure out, you know, well, the establishment figures out how to, you know, stop a potential Trump Cruz unity ticket from railroading everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, or, you know, accept Trump with conditions, i.e., you know, get an establishment VP pick. Or, you know, you see John Kasich stick it through because, I mean, there aren't as many winner-take-all states as it's being portrayed. Like, for example, Maryland is not a pure winner-take-all state. We're actually a hybrid state where we're going to be similar to a lot of other states where we're going to elect our delegates on a proportional basis by congressional district, but winner-take-all by congressional district. So a John Kasich could be a spoiler running into Cleveland. You know, Marco Rubio could still play the role of spoiler running into Cleveland. I don't see, you know, Rubio's speech as a coalescing around Trump. Actually, I know for a fact that most of his guys are splitting and going either Team Cruz or Team Kasich. You know, and I think for a lot of folks, especially those that have been around for a while, it's hard to wrap your head and hands around Trump. To see, you know, the work that you put in the movement for the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years is wiped and blown away by one person. It's hard for a lot of people.
Donald Trump did blow up the dreams and aspirations of many a Republican political strategist and consultant. And Eugene,
yeah, Trump is the media's making. But, you know, you still have 60, 70% of Republicans voting against him. And if he doesn't win this thing on the first ballot in Cleveland, he's not going to be the nominee.
Yeah, but Eugene, I mean, when you look at these results, I mean, in Florida, he got 46%. Illinois, just shy of 40. Missouri, it's tied. It's sort of tied right now. Mm-hmm. They still haven't completely tabulated those results, but he's around 41%. North Carolina, 40. So he's crossed that 35% threshold. And so, Kimberly, I want to get your thoughts. I mean, is there – do Republicans now – okay, two questions here. One, I'm not convinced that there will be a brokered or contested convention because Republican – you know, I've worked on both sides of the aisle. I work for Republicans, too. I work for Democrats. Republicans, at the end of the day, they like winners, and they like to be very disciplined, like to have, you know, unified messaging.
Well, that's not happening right now, though.
That's not happening right now, but by the time we get to the convention, they're going to want that, right? And I'm just not – I'm not buying that yet. I think it's kind of hype. That's just me. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced of that completely. And I just see now voters across a variety of demographic segments within the Republican primary electorate coalescing, now accepting that, okay, this is our guy. And so one question, do you see that? And two, is Donald Trump the best hope to control the lumpen Republican proletariat, you know, the pitchfork and fire breathing cats who were at the gates, the barbarians at the gates, so to speak, who've been, you know, who've actually kind of been caught up in a lot of this racial dog whistling that's been going on.
Yeah. So it's interesting because I think there are so many people who are anti-Hillary enough to ensure that they'll decide to vote for Trump if he turns out to be the nominee, which is unfortunate. I mean, not because I'm making a political platform, but simply because, you know, I dislike this person so much that I'll take the alternative is really interesting. But I, you know, one of the other things that I think needs to that isn't being talked about, even in the midst of all of this conversation around some of the racial rhetoric that Trump is using at his rallies, is we're unwilling to have the conversation about the role of race for him, per se. And by that, I mean, I see him as the true manifestation of what white privilege looks like. And by that, I'm speaking specifically of here we have an individual who has been successful in various ways that I don't want to strip that away from him. But I do want to speak specifically to the fact that this is a candidate that is without any of the credentials and expertise that we see necessary to run a nation or to participate as a politician in any other realm of the political arena. But yet we as a nation, at least that's the echo that we're hearing now, seems to be the best option. And I say it simply because he embodies what we consider quintessential whiteness, that he embraces an understanding of how people are feeling and unwilling to say. And because he's become that mouthpiece that is willing to say some of the things that in our PC culture we've considered too taboo, he now is that voice, that person that we see. And so for me, that's quintessential white privilege. Like, you don't have the ability to do all of this stuff, but because of who you happen to be, someone who embodies white skin, white privilege, I'm going to allow you access to this particular space.
Hey Tom, the race narrative, the racial tensions have been very prominent in this election cycle. You know, something also I noticed, Tom, and I want to see if you're seeing that as well, you know, kind of looking at the outcomes of these races, the polling trends. States that Trump has handily won are also very diverse states. And I'm wondering, what does that say? What does that say about that quintessential whiteness, as, you know, as Kimberly describes it, how that's playing out, particularly throughout the Republican primary electorate in the most diverse states? He picked up New Hampshire. But the states that Ted Cruz picks up are pretty much, I mean, they're very white states. And then, but the other states that Trump's been picking up, they're very diverse states where there's a lot of interface and interaction between whites and a lot of people of color, black and brown people. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or any reflections on that.
Well, a couple. I mean, I agree with Kimberly. And first of all, he's, you know, winning those diverse states, but he's winning them with the white voters in those states. And I would actually refer back to the Democratic primary in 2008, where we saw, and I think Democrats had to sort of grapple with this notion within their own party because they view themselves as a much more, you know, racially liberalized and racially tolerant party, where Obama was winning the states where there was such a big black vote, southern states, black belt states, that even though white voters were going for Hillary, he had enough votes in the black community to win. And then he was also winning, ironically, these lily white states, these small caucus states in the West and the Northeast over her. Where she was winning is in states where there was a significant black vote, enough that there was racial polarization within the Democratic Party, but there wasn't enough black voters. She won, you know, the Arkansas and the Texas and Ohio and Pennsylvania and so forth. Fast forward 8 years now, and what you have with Trump is, you know, he's, you know, you look at his rallies, there's, like, there's an occasional minority conservative there, but it's a lily white crowd, of course. And he's winning those states in the primary, and the question is whether he can win them in the general.
Let me just sort of clarify. So does that say something about those white voters, about their perceptions about people of color in their states? You know, that's what I mean by that, by the fact that he's winning diverse states. He's tapping into, like, some interstate racial resentment there.
Absolutely.
Well, of course. I mean, one out of four of his self-described voters, you know, in some of these polls say that, that slaves should have been freed after the end of the Civil War. I mean, it's hard to come any more face-to-face with racism in the United States than people who think that, you know, 12% of the population shouldn't even be considered citizens, but should be considered property. That's a pretty damning statistic, even if it's only one out of four of a Trump base of support, which is about 40% of about 30% of the country that's Republican voting in these primaries. And remember, you know, all these Trump voters, if you add them up, they're 7 or 8 or 9% of the country. And as an American, you can put your head on the pillow at night saying, well, it's only 7 or 8 or 9% of the country. But you can also be like, well, geez, that's still 1 out of 10 people on the street. You know, that's a pretty daunting thing to have to sort of wrap your head around in 2016.
I want to get to Eugene. I want to get Eugene's thoughts on the notion of a brokered convention in Cleveland. I just said a few moments earlier, I'm not buying that just yet. But, I mean, what are you seeing, Eugene? I mean, and what's sort of the chatter within the GOP, one, about a brokered convention happening? What kind of role do you see congressional Republicans playing and how they're kind of reacting to this? And, I mean, we do have some critical Senate races that are taking place. They've got to be nervous about a potential Donald Trump nomination heading into November.
Well, I think there's a couple things at play. Starting with the Trump phenomenon has not transcended down ballot, i.e., we haven't seen a single incumbent lose their primary, you know, re-election and grab the nomination like we did in 2010. When it comes to a open convention in Cleveland, I think you're looking. The issue is this: Donald Trump does not have an organization. So the majority of people that are being elected delegates to the convention, both on the Democrat and Republican side, typically tend to be your party insiders, the people that know the rules of the party, and know how to run and get elected as a delegate. Donald Trump does not have one that, you know, that institutional knowledge within his camp. Secondly, he doesn't have the organizational strength. I mean, this guy is pretty much running an entirely media-focused campaign with very little ground game, which is going to hurt him if he doesn't secure 1237, a bound delegate, you know, on the first ballot. If this thing, and, you know, the other thing that's at play, you know, I've spoken to a couple folks that sit on a couple committees within the RNC. I know for a fact that, you know, Rule 40, which has been a lot of talk about, you know, eight state threshold where you have to have a majority of delegates. That eight states, which was put in place to prevent Ron Paul and Rick Santorum from having their names put in nomination in 2012, was raised from 5 to 8 states, is going to be brought back down. I don't know what it's going to be brought back down to, but I know it's going to be brought back down. I've heard proposals from anybody that got a delegate will be deemed, you know, able to put their name in nomination, which will open up to like 8 candidates, or bring it down to like 3 or 4, you know, 3 or 4 state thresholds, which would allow for a Rubio or, you know, even a Kasich, depending on how this thing plays out, to have their name put in nomination along with Cruz and Trump. But if Trump does not secure this on the first round of balloting, you know, you'll see, you know, a very, very interesting open convention in the floor in Cleveland.
And, Kimberly, also, I want to ask, there was some breaking news that actually came out while we were on the phone. President Obama nominating Merrick Garland.
Oh, I hadn't heard.
Yeah, that just I'm
I
just
thought it was supposed
this.
To be at 11 today.
Right. That just word just came out.
Okay.
Merrick Garland. Who is Merrick Garland? Like, right. And another white dude is going on the Supreme Court, essentially. And so, you know, obviously a lot of folks probably a bit stupefied by that pick. Real quick, want to ask you, especially in light of last night's results, how this now plays out with this. Obviously, Senate Republicans saying, you know, no, we're not going to consider any nominee from President Obama. So how does this play out for the Republican primary electorate? How does this help a candidate like Donald Trump? How does this perhaps help someone like Ted Cruz, who's looking for, you know, something to happen, you know, something to kind of get him ahead of or to catch up with Donald Trump?
Yeah, I'm not sure how it'll be used, but it should be used, I mean, as a force to mm-hmm. rally Republicans around the notion that this mm-hmm. is not a move they believe mm-hmm. President Obama should have access to. And, I mean, I think the Republican Party has been those who are sitting representatives and senators have made it clear that they have no desire to mm-hmm. even engage the president on this particular nomination. And so I do think not necessarily will it make a difference between Trump or Cruz, but I do think it will make a difference for them to speak to this mm-hmm. particular issue and the fact that there has been someone named mm-hmm. for nomination to make sure they are rallying other Republicans around the notion that, yes, we should be the ones, if they are in office, mm-hmm. of course, we should be the ones that are able to make that decision. But I'd love to hear what Eugene has to say on that one.
Right. I'd love to hear what Eugene has to say as well. Real quick, Eugene, before I get to you, and we got about a couple more minutes before we hit the break, but Tom, I want to get your thoughts as well. If you multitask while you're on radio and you just happen to see Merrick Garland.
Yeah, I was watching it on TV in the background on mute. I mean, I think this is Obama recognizing that the Republicans are going to stick to their word and not
right.
confirm anybody. Mm-hmm. And so I think he's okie-doking them a little bit. Like, there were 22 yeah. or 23 Republicans who voted to confirm him to the D.C. Circuit back in 97, including seven Republican senators. I don't know exactly which seven they are, but it's been reported seven of them are still in the Senate today. So they're going to have to go up and say, not only are we going to give a vote to this guy, this is a guy I voted to confirm.
Right.
Previously.
Eugene?
And they could say, well, it was D.C. Circuit versus Supreme Court. I'm sure they'll say that.
Right.
And then in the end, you know, give Garland credit because he's probably the sacrificial lamb here.
Mm.
And if Hillary Clinton wins the White House, then Sri Sivanis, and I don't know how to say his last name, is still on the docket where I think it's harder to renominate whoever Obama puts out there today. So I think he's saying, you know, here's your sacrificial lamb. He's your own guy, sort of.
Yeah, Eugene, real quick, I think we're about 30 seconds.
You know, I think, you know, the Senate has a role of advising. It's not a rubber stamp for the president. And, you know, I think the president made a mistake here. If you really wanted to, you know, play politics with the Supreme Court pick a conservative. They didn't challenge Republicans on that.
I think you should have picked a black woman, to be honest.
Well,
really, yeah, you know, mobilize, kind of galvanize the black vote.
Well, you pick a black woman conservative and maintain the balance on the court. You know, you know that anybody that's not, you know, at least mildly right-leaning is going to get through or even get a confirmation hearing, then you know, you're setting yourself up for failure. But you're setting yourself up for failure. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to be able to replace Antonin Scalia with an Anthony Kennedy, like mm-hmm. justice. I mean, mm-hmm. that's not going to happen. You know, quite frankly, if I was President Obama, I would have made the appointment of Mike Lee or Ted Cruz. And then dare Senate Republicans not to confirm them.
All right.
No way. There's not a seat for a conservative that's replaced with a conservative. That's not how it works.
We have to take a very brief break. Don't go away. So we'll be right back. We have here Dr. Kimberly Moffitt in studio. Dr. Thomas Shaler, he's on phone. Also, Eugene Craig also joining us by phone. We'll continue our conversation regarding last night's primary results. We're going to, after the break, on the other side, we're going to talk about what happened on the Democratic side. A lot happening there as well. On our way to break, I want to remind you, from school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues impacting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at marylandeducators.org. That's marylandeducators.org. We'll be right back. Charles Ellison sitting in for Mark Steiner here on your source for Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. You can catch us at Steiner Show on Twitter. At Mark Steiner on Twitter. Steinershow.org is the website. You can call in if you have any comments or questions for our esteemed panel of guests, 410-319-8888. I was about to throw somebody's number out there. I was about to give folks like one of the panelists' numbers. This is what you know. You got somebody's phone was about to blow up. I heard you earlier on Mark Steiner's show. I don't agree. He's about to get all these like a fury of texts. But sorry about that. 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Also steinershow.org. We've got Dr. Kimberly Moffitt here in studio. She's an associate professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Also, her colleague, Dr. Thomas Shaler, he's a professor of political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, also writes a political column for the Baltimore Sun. And Eugene Craig is a grassroots activist and third vice chair of the Maryland State Republican Party, all friends of the Mark Steiner Show, joining us to talk about last night's primary results. We had quite a few states in contention, some that are actually major battleground states during the presidential election: Florida, Illinois, Missouri, North Carolina, Ohio. Let's talk about the Democratic side, what happened there. You have essentially Hillary Clinton handily, with the exception of Missouri. So it seems like everything is contested.
We're still waiting
Missouri.
For Missouri, right?
Yes,
yeah,
all, you know, show me.
Okay.
Like, show me the votes. So show me state. Show me the votes. We're still waiting on those votes. And Hillary getting about 65%, winning handily in Florida, just barely in Illinois, and 55% in North Carolina, 57%. In Ohio. Mm-hmm. Kimberly, let's start with you. So what does that say about Hillary Clinton now? Because we've been having a conversation for quite a long time about the ascendancy of Bernie Sanders. So what, folks stop feeling the burn? What's going on there?
It's interesting because I do think Bernie is still in the fight, but mm-hmm. I think it does appear to be that he is handily losing it at the mm-hmm. same time. And I read a piece this morning that talked about Michigan may have just been a fluke and not really right. guaranteed for Bernie in the way of sending this message of we want him versus Hillary. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also interesting that it based on who is voting for Hillary Clinton, it seems to be a clear message of we still are more comfortable with the establishment and not with this other entity that we mm-hmm. don't really know or understand. Mm-hmm. And even just, you know, in terms of general conversations, what you hear people speak about is the fact of Bernie Sanders being much older mm-hmm. and not really connecting with him right. as an older gentleman, even though certainly in the African-American community, he has this kind of history to be able to speak back to of what mm-hmm. he has done and how he has invested himself in very much addressing issues of civil rights and human rights in general. Mm-hmm. But I do, especially when I read the percentages of African-American voters in all these states, handily supporting mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton, it sends a very clear message to me that that particular segment of the population is much more comfortable with what they consider to be the establishment and what they feel like mm-hmm. they are most comfortable with because they're also connecting her to mm-hmm. her husband.
Mm-hmm. Tom, what say you? Is it about, you know, sort of embracing the establishment candidate, embracing the machine that supports her, or is it simply about, you know what, we just want to kind of go with what we know. We want to go with what we sense is experience, the devil we know as opposed to the devil we don't know. What do you think that that's happening there?
I think it's something of the line like that. My theory of the case, so to speak, for this year's election, if there's all this voter anger, which there is, and there was all this dissensus in the two nomination contests, which there has been some, I think, obviously more on the Republican side with the rise of Trump, then we should be staring down the barrel of this populist revolt producing Bernie Sanders and mm-hmm. Trump. Instead, we're going to get Trump and Clinton. So what is it that pairs those two together? And here's my theory of the case. In 2000, we had George W. Bush campaigning as I'm a uniter, not a divider. He was staring into what we now see, which is even more pronounced, the polarization of the country, in red America and blue America, and this very chasmic division between the country's left and right, which keeps growing and is evident on every measure that political science take, whether it's Senate and House roll call votes or people's approval of the presidents of the United States based on their partisanship and so forth. We are very polarized. He gets a national event, potentially unifying event, a security threat broadcast live on national TV. The country is no more unified by the time he leaves office and, in fact, more polarized. Mm. Along comes Barack Obama in a developing economic crisis. He says, I'm not from red America or blue America. I represent the United States of America. Same message, Democratic candidate. I can heal and bind up the wounds and develop bipartisan solutions and work with the other side. Same message as Bush. Mm. And 8 years later, perhaps through no fault of his own, maybe partially his fault, the country is no more unified after 8 years of Obama, and he had a giant economic crisis that, in theory, could have unified the country. And I think the country, after 16 years of sort of being sold this notion that the country can be fixed with bipartisan solutions and a healer president, they're like, no, I think the country's ready to double down on its own side. And the doubling down candidates on their own side are Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. They are the two candidates in their respective primaries with the highest negatives. And we are going to see a knockdown, drag out fight for the presidency that's going to make Clinton versus Dole or Bush versus Kerry or Gore versus Bush or certainly Romney versus Obama look like a patty cake love fest compared to what we're going to do this fall. That's my theory.
Interesting. Eugene, I'd like to get your thoughts as far as what was happening on the other side last night, the states where they were happening. And, you know, do you now kind of see that there could be an issue for turnout? Or an enthusiasm gap? Did you notice any sort of, seem to be still there's this concern, particularly on the Democratic side, that there's this enthusiasm gap, massive enthusiasm gap between Democrats and Republicans. Do you expect some of that in the general as well?
Oh, absolutely. I think the time where you're going to get the most enthusiasm is during your primary, at least within your party. And I do see that enthusiasm gap, and I think it's going to help Republicans tremendously regardless of who the nominee is. But I think going forward, the Clinton machine and the Dem establishment, they're going to have to find a way to pull Team Bernie into the fold, or at least extend a hand. What I see playing out here on the Dem side is very reminiscent to the Ron Paul Mitt Romney dogfight after Santorum got the race in 2012. Where you had an extreme amount of enthusiasm on the Ron Paul side and, the Romney wing of the party, they were, okay, we have our nominee, let's just keep moving forward. But you have, a coalition of mostly young and, young and diverse people pushing this alternate candidate still. And the establishment wasn't able to find a way to pull them into the fold, and we got 4 more years of Barack Obama. And I think that's what's playing out on the Dem side right now. It's very, very eerily reminiscent of 2012 being a Ron Paul supporter.
But you look at real quick, Eugene. You've got to be worried though about how Hillary Clinton's numbers look. And even though it's just the Democratic primary electorate, she still managed fairly sizable leads in places like Florida and Ohio. Those are going to be key states that Republicans will need in their pathway to the White House. So you've got to be worried how last night looks, especially in a state like Florida. She just looked very commanding in terms of her lead there. Not too bad in a spot like North Carolina as well, which that's something that over the past several cycles, North Carolina has also grown into a key state as well.
Well, I'm not so much concerned. This is not an endorsement of Donald Trump, but one thing I will say about Donald Trump is that to a degree he does reshape the political calculus and map. Most of the states that he's been winning up until recently were all open primary states, i.e. Democrats and independents could come in and vote for the Republican in a Republican ballot. You're seeing in places like Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, where you're having 20,000 and 30,000 Dems defect just to vote for Donald Trump. I think, you know, if you come down to a Trump-Clinton battle, especially if Hillary Clinton's indicted, you know, I think you see a reshaping of the political math and calculus that, you know, I don't think any of us are prepared for.
And how do you know, real quick, how do you know those Democrats weren't voting for Trump because they just feel like, you know, they want to sabotage the Republican nomination process? They just feel like, you know, Trump is the candidate we want Hillary Clinton to go against. Trump is the best chance for Democrats to reach the White House.
You know, I typically don't buy, you know, we're going to quote unquote, you know, massively go and vote for a candidate just to sabotage and whatnot.
Yeah.
You know, that takes an extreme organizational effort, months in planning and, you know, having people, you know, it's almost like running a full campaign itself. I've never bought that kind of train of thought.
Hey, Kimberly, I want to ask you now. This is what I kind of envision happening because Bernie Sanders doesn't seem like the type of candidate who wants to go anywhere. He's raised a lot of money. However, now, as far as the delegate count, you've got Hillary Clinton kind of halfway there.
Yeah.
And, you know, so now there's quite a bit of distance between her and Bernie Sanders in terms of the delegate count. There's talk of her being, you know, sort of the presumptive nominee. I see him making a lot of noise at the convention. I also see his supporters crafting this narrative of, you know, you see, the process was rigged. You know, so what do you say? I mean, this is a candidate who talked a lot about political revolution, but then relied a lot on very shrewd political tactics and strategy. I mean, he admitted, hey, I became a Democrat because I wanted to raise more money and I wanted to get more media.
Yeah.
But he's talking about political revolution. I mean, what do you see happening from this point
forward? So, but he couldn't create that political revolution outside of the two-party system, because we as Americans have so bought into that it's hard, even though we do have potentially other political party candidates, our notion of even buying into a Green Party candidate or someone who might be running as an independent just doesn't appeal to most Americans. Mm. That they squarely see themselves situated in red or blue somewhere, and all those in between just don't seem to resonate with them in a particular way.
Which now the number of independents, however, or people identifying themselves as independents.
Absolutely. I agree with that point, but I still say in terms of when we are entering into our polling sites to make decisions, we are still squarely situated in this particular camp. Yes, absolutely. And I think the rise of independents being registered is to say we have a problem with it, but yet we're so committed to that two-party system that I think it still draws us into one corner or another.
Is it commitment or committed to that two-party process, or is it just lack of familiarity with the political process?
I don't know. I do think we are
apprehension about it.
Absolutely. And we're comfortable with what we know, even though it's not what we like.
Right.
And I think there's a tendency for us to move to the default instead of really be the revolutionaries that we think we can be. Mm-hmm. I don't want to sound as though I'm negating Bernie's campaign, because I do think it plays a substantial role in at least bringing to awareness that Americans are frustrated and that they do want to see something different, and that, you know, of the almost 8 years of President Obama, I agree with Tom that it has done nothing, and I don't mean this disparagingly about the president, but it has certainly participated in the divisiveness that we see in our country. And that can be that could be represented in multiple ways, you know, whether or not it's about race, whether or not it's about his sheer politics or his ability or his willingness to, you know, make certain positions that seem so far-fetched from what most Americans would want him to do. But I do believe there is a very substantial role that Bernie is playing in this conversation, at
Charles,
least as
may,
a conversation.
I definitely want to get your thoughts on that.
The scientist in me, you know, the reason we have a very stable two-party system, and have had it since really the Civil War, is because of, and especially since 1967, is because we have single-member districts with plurality rule. It makes it very difficult for third-party candidacies and independent candidacies, even if they can get on the ballot,
to win any seats because there's no reward for second or third or certainly not fourth like there are in proportional representation systems, which is why, you know, Ross Perot got 19% of the vote in 1992 and won zero electoral votes. He didn't finish first in any of the states. So our electoral college, if you think about it, is a single-member district. Each state is its own district, and it's winner-take-all with a plurality of the vote. You just got to get 45%. I mean, Bill Clinton only got 50% in one state, Arkansas, in 1992, but he won enough electoral votes. And then all of our congressional districts, with the exception of Georgia and Louisiana, which have runoffs, are single-member districts. Whoever gets the most vote, you don't even need to get 50% wins. And so political scientists have shown, and the empirical evidence is very clear, it's hard to start a third party, and the two parties really do have a duopoly, and they have no incentive to change those current rules.
Mm-hmm. Got it. I'm going to get a caller in here. He's been waiting very patiently. I just noticed Clarence from Baltimore. Clarence, how are you doing? Can you hear me?
Hey, yes, I can hear you. I beg to differ with the young lady that just spoke. I don't think we see ourselves as red or blue or in any way at all. Most of us don't. But when you are experts at splitting the social consciousness, like both of the leadership in both of these parties are, you get a skewed vision as to what your interests are. You mentioned in the black community that most people in the black community are comfortable with the established order. No, that just shows you how skewed their view of what their interests really are. Because when you look at Bernie and you look at Hillary, even though I don't believe Bernie has any chance of accomplishing all of the things that he says, that social revolution, economic prosperity, and leveling the playing field, I don't think he can accomplish that for one of the things one of your other guests mentioned. You have the man that you put in the office versus the system. Barack Obama put the same message out there, as he mentioned with George Bush. Bernie Sanders, the same thing. You get in the office and you've got guns pointed at your head from both directions saying, no, no, no. It's not the man, it's the system. So, you know, I would disagree with both of your comments on your ideas of what's happening here. It's a skewed vision. That's what separates us. That's why one of the reasons why at my house, CNN, MSNBC, none of that. I will not watch anything with a red, white, and blue background with a scrolling marquee down at the bottom of it. Period. You know? Thank you.
All right.
I don't disagree with anything that Clarence has said. I mean, I do think it is about a skew perception, but that skew perception draws us to one side or the other. Mm-hmm. And we don't see ourselves as having the ability to create or step out and foster something that looks very different. Mm-hmm. And so we hear or see the bubbling up happening within these two parties instead of there being something separate.
Hey, you know, Eugene, I want to get your thoughts as well. As far as, you know, you've had on both sides of the partisan aisle, essentially, and kind of touching on a little bit of what Clarence, the caller, just said, essentially two angry white men, you know, not really, and really what they're saying is not really too different from one another. I mean, the contours, the structure, the sentence structure, the words employed, you know, obviously that's a bit different. You've got Trump blaming the brown people crossing the border and pretty much Bernie Sanders blaming Wall Street, right? But I mean, really just these two angry white guys tapping into this populist rage. What do you make of that?
that's actually pretty interesting. I mean, you got Trump blaming the brown people coming across the border, and you have, you know, Bernie blaming the brown people on the other side of the border.
How's that?
Yeah, what?
That's curious.
Well, I mean, his push of pretty much anti-trade with NAFTA and CAFTA and TPP. It's been boiling down to the others are the ones that screwing you. That's what it's been boiling down to, and it is a common denominator in both candidacies. I don't know how that's going to play out come general election wise. I do think that there is a slight possibility that Donald Trump could take, you know, the disaffected Sanders wing and, you know, the voters that he's garnered and form a new coalition. But I think we have to sit back, wait and see.
Tom, as far as, you know, sort of where this Democratic primary is now headed, Bernie and his supporters, a lot of his supporters saying that if Hillary Clinton becomes the nominee, they're just going to they're not going to participate in this election. They're going to sit this one out when we get to November. So I see Bernie Sanders supporters creating this story, weaving this tale of this rigged process of how the Clinton machine stomped all over them unfairly, how, you know, basically they owned the Democratic Party apparatus. And so could we see some sort of contested convention in Philly as well?
I don't think so. I feel like we heard this 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. Substitute Obama for Hillary.
Right.
Substitute Hillary for Bernie. And, you know, she went far deeper into the process. I mean, I guess he'll still go, but she was still legitimately fighting until May 5th when she lost in Indiana. And you know, remember, party came together despite the threats of the Pumas and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but let me stop you there real quick. Now, I'll let you – real quick, though, let me just say – but Bernie not being, you know, Obama really not being a Bernie not really being an Obama. I mean, Bernie just recently just signed on to be a Democrat. So, you know, in a sense, he could kind of come at it from the perspective of someone who politically he feels like he has nothing to lose.
Well, that may be true. But I think, it's, you know, when when John McCain picked Sarah Palin, that moved all those women who were threatening to stay home from Hillary Clinton. And they're not even going to have to look to the VP this time. First of all, she's already endorsed Trump. We'll expect to be the nominee. And I don't think those Sanders voters are going to turn out to vote for the, you know, inherited millionaire guy, given all the message of Bernie Sanders. And I think Sanders will do the right thing in the end, and he'll have a prominent role probably on Tuesday night in Philadelphia. That'll be his night. You know, they'll probably have Obama and Bill Clinton on Monday night, and whoever she picks as her VP. Maybe she'll pick him as VP, by the way. Maybe he'll be talking on Wednesday night. That could be interesting, too. But I think whatever divisions there are divisions in the Democratic Party. They pale by comparison to what's going on the other side of the aisle. And I think ultimately the party will come together as it did 8 years ago.
I'm going to throw this question out to all three of you, and we'll start with Kimberly. Now, we've had this conversation for several weeks now. It's been a lot. You know, on some levels, it's rather encouraging. You know, it's kind of positive on some levels when people are so focused on the black electorate or the needs and concerns of black voters. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been having that conversation, especially in terms of, you know, seeing who's black enough, Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. That's encouraging on one level, but that's also got to be risky, particularly for someone like Hillary Clinton. You focus so much on black voters because you're trying to get those black voters in those primary states, but you do that at the expense of white voters.
Which is exactly what we've
seen.
You're
going to need that in the general election, yeah. Right? We've seen that.
Yeah, we've seen that throughout the primaries.
Exactly.
That she's not getting.
How does she manage that?
I don't think she's doing it well right now. Mm-hmm. And maybe there is a shift coming as she gets closer to that 2300 number. Mm-hmm. That she'll recognize that there is a need. I do have concerns for her her campaign, though, because I do think there is such a large anti-Hillary faction. Mm-hmm. That she may not be able to actually bring such individuals into the fold to support her campaign, and possibly they will choose to vote for someone else, or they will stay home and not participate in the process. Mm-hmm. I personally cannot wrap my head around not participating in the process, but I get why people would want to make a decision to say, I am so not connected to a particular candidate that I'll choose just not to participate at all.
Mm-hmm. Real quick, Kimberly, as far as, you know, we're talking about black voters, a lot of Democratic strategists I talk to still worry black voters aren't going to turn out in November, not in big numbers.
But they seem to be turning out in the primaries, though.
Right, right.
I mean, and so if she's able to continue.
So something we're underestimating there.
And if there's, right. I mean, if she's able to continue that wave into the general election, I don't think that would be the case. And if Trump is the nominee, I think, and continues to say many of the inflammatory remarks that he's making around brown and black bodies, that might be enough to mobilize the black electorate to come out and actually support.
Now, continuing that conversation on the black electorate, Eugene, black voters coming out, obviously, in huge enough numbers to get Hillary Clinton over the top as far as the nomination, but still Democratic voter participation much lower than Republican voter primary participation in a lot of these key states, right?
Absolutely.
That's the counter argument to that.
No, I don't. You know, you're seeing, you know, higher Republican voter turnout in the primaries, and I think somewhat stagnant or returned to normalcy out from 2008. mm-hmm. voter participation in the Democrat primary. My concern when it comes to the black vote is I think, you know, as a community, we've kind of hit a ceiling mm-hmm. on the effectiveness. And I think, you know, going forward, looking at 18 to 20, regardless of what happens in 16, I think you're going to see a shift of the black vote, you know, playing both sides and diversifying their voting portfolio, if I could use that term. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if there was active engagement on both sides of the aisle, you'll see we would have seen a lot more traction on criminal justice reform rather than having to push Bernie Sanders on it, which then pushed Hillary Clinton on it. You know, it would have been in the forefront, especially when, you know, your voting bloc is significant to a particular party. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you have a situation where the party can't take you for granted anymore because you're playing both sides the same way the Latino community does and the Asian community does mm-hmm. and other communities do, you know, I think, you know, you're going to see the value of the black vote increase tremendously over the next couple cycles.
Tom, I wanted you to jump in. We have about 2 minutes before we wrap up this segment. Tom, as far as how Hillary manages that balance between, you know, there's been so much focus on the black vote, but then she's got to shift to white voters, especially blue-collar white voters. You know, there's a lot of angst with that segment. How does she do that?
Let me make three very quick points in 2 minutes because I don't think it's a problem. Number one, Hillary Clinton's going to start off this campaign as the first woman nominee for president. And that's going to have a value, and she's going to have Barack Obama over one shoulder and her husband, excuse me, over the other shoulder, the president who still has a very strong
slip.
Draw with many white voters. And that is a dynamic combination that nobody in American history will have going into the general election. Point two is that Trump's best states with these white votes are those Appalachian counties and northern upstate New York, where I'm from, counties that we saw famously in the 2008 map when Obama did worse in those counties than John Kerry, even though Obama won and Kerry lost. And so what does that do for Donald Trump? He picks up more white votes in Arkansas and West Virginia. West Virginia is his number one state. How many electoral votes does that add to the Republican coalition? Zero. And so maybe he shaves Hillary Clinton's margins down in two of his other strongest states, Massachusetts and New York, but he can't beat her in those states. The margins are 25% for Obama in those states. And so how many electoral votes do the Democrats lose from that? Zero. So Trump may push his percentage up, but I don't think it's going to net any extra electoral votes for him.
Hey, Tom, I got to cut you off there because, we have to end the show. But thanks so much. We had Dr. Kimberly Moffitt with University of Maryland, Baltimore County, Associate Professor of American Studies here in studio. Also, Dr. Thomas Shaler with Professor of Political Science at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, also political columnist on Baltimore Sun. He's been joining us by phones. Also, Eugene Craig, grassroots activist and third vice chair of the Maryland State Republican Party. Some great insights. I'm probably going to reach out to all of you offline at some point in the next week or so. Really appreciate you being here, joining us on the Mark Steiner Show. And also thanks to those calling in and tweeting in. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll have a conversation with Michelle, the indie mom of comedy, about her project, the Sankofa Entrepreneurs Project, making a great living while impacting greatly. So for an hour, I'm going to talk about something else other than politics. Right. We'll be right back here on the Mark Steiner Show here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.